Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. The concept of artificial intelligence in terms of digital computing has been around since the mid-1950s. The field was actually born at a workshop at Dartmouth College in 1956 when a group of computer scientists, cognitive scientists, and an economist decided to begin pursuing research into whether early computers could be programmed to solve complicated problems and maybe even eventually do any work humans could do. Researchers have continued to work in this field since then, and these days, while there might not yet be the kind of artificial general intelligence those early researchers first imagined, there are lots of ways computers are doing the work only humans could once do, much of it behind the scenes in the systems that we all take for granted. Joining me now is Dr. Larry Hall. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Florida. Dr. Hall has done research in pattern recognition, artificial intelligence, and machine learning throughout his career, with more than 270 peer-reviewed publications. He has current funding from the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. He's in town to present a lecture at Florida Gulf Coast University as part of the Provost's lecture series. It's called Artificial Intelligence Through Deep Learning. So we thought we'd sit down with him to pick his brain about this still advancing field. Dr. Hall, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Our conversation is pre-taped, so we're not taking calls, but if you would like to engage with us via social media, we are on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So what's the most distilled description you can give our listeners of what we mean these days by artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence would be any program that exhibits what we've come to think of as human intelligence. So it interacts with you in a way that you feel that there could be, even if you know that there isn't, there could be a human behind it. Think of a chatbot. Most chatbots are, in fact, artificial intelligences.
Does it require a human thinking what they're doing or interacting with might be a human for it to be artificial intelligence?
So that you just asked, does it have to pass the Turing test, a classical test that the people in the early days said we would know something is an artificial intelligence when you put it behind a wall and you have a human behind the wall and you can't tell who you're talking to. And so, no, it doesn't have to pass the Turing test per se. There's in very narrow areas, AIs have passed the Turing test, but even a narrow area, there's a lot of room to confuse the AI.
Right.
And I think, again, coming back to chatbots, which we do tend to interact with, and what they do is when they don't know what to do is they give it to a human.
Gotcha. I just had that happen with Verizon this morning. How did you first get involved in this field of research?
When I was a graduate student at Florida State University, there were some faculty that were working in pattern recognition, which was kind of the precursor to machine learning and AI, not AI, but concurrent with AI. And so I thought that was really interesting, try to recognize patterns and make sense of them. And part of that, AI is one piece of that, or it's a piece of AI. You can argue both.
You were in graduate school in the 1980s, you said?
Yes, 1980s.
How did you foresee the future unfolding, and how has it unfolded in terms of this field and where the hopes were versus the reality is today?
It's an interesting question. I think that when I was in school, the idea was that expert systems would help replace experts, and it didn't happen. So there became an AI winter, which people sort of moved away from artificial intelligence. But at the same time, people were developing these things called neural networks, which were learning machines. There are other learning machines, and neural networks were supposed to learn things. There's a theorem that says a neural network can learn arbitrarily closely approximate any function, which means basically should be able to learn everything. It's unfortunate that you don't know that it can actually do it, and you don't know the parameters you need. But there was a lot of hype there, too. That also didn't pan out. I worked on that, and it didn't pan out. So then it seemed like machine learning was going to be, I think, the wave of the future, and it has been up until now, where deep learning, a piece of machine learning, you know, has taken off. So it didn't really unfold in the spectacular way people thought it might in the mid-80s or the way they thought neural networks would in the mid-90s. But now there's some real applications. I mean, Yeah.
Real quick, to define neural network, in a layman's term.
So neural network is something that you have inputs and outputs, which is sort of obvious. So there'll be some input features, and then you'll output maybe a class. For example, you might say a class of, I'm looking at objects, what are basketballs, right? You guys have a good basketball team down here, I heard. So you would be able to do that and differentiate it from a football or whatever. And it has internal nodes that are really very simple. They sum up the weights of the inputs, and they have some weights on the links to the inputs, and then they put it through a function and output that, and they do that to another layer of network nodes. And you do that until you get to the outputs, and whap, out comes number, and you say if this one's higher, if you're classifying, you say, yep, basketball. Nope, not basketball.
And all the nodes that are making those sort of decisions, that's all been programmed by someone in advance?
No, that's all learned.
That's all learned. So that's where we get to the machine learning part. So define machine learning.
Machine learning would be taking some data and building a model from that data. And the model can be predictive of classes, or it can be generating numbers, like a regression kind of problem. And so it's essentially building models. I think the simplest way to say it is to build models from data.
Gotcha. So that's where we are with artificial intelligence now. You hear this term artificial general intelligence is what people imagine when, like, you know, when there's a robot that can walk around and pretend to be a human. We're talking about two different, entirely different things here. I mean, they might converge at some point, but we're not – that's not – or is it?
I think the artificial general intelligence is – still a way off. That's what people sometimes call the singularity.
Right.
When I have a robot that is able to impersonate a human, or I can interact with it just like I'm interacting with you, and while I see it's a robot, I don't have to change what I'm doing. That's with conventional computing. I don't see that happening anywhere in the near future. If you go to quantum computing, well, I wouldn't be willing to bet on it not.
Quantum computing's still an X factor, right?
It's an X factor.
So the AI learned model AlphaGo is something that I think people may have heard about in the news. It's, a good way to demonstrate what you're talking about. Is that correct?
Yes. So there's actually a thing called Alpha Zero now that's beyond AlphaGo. And it plays not just Go, but it plays also chess and checkers, I believe, and it learns completely by playing against itself. It does know the rules, and then it learns about by playing against itself, and it has some search. AlphaGo had a little bit deeper search, as I recall, than AlphaZero, but AlphaZero is more flexible, can learn different games. And the bottom line is that if you're a Go player or you're a chess player, you now have to be the best human in the world, because you're not going to be the best in the world, it doesn't look like. That's going to be reserved for the computers.
Right, because the Go thing was, you know, we went from computers couldn't even touch humans to now humans can't even touch computers in a relatively short period of time, if I'm not mistaken, right?
You're correct. And that is because the neural networks, the learning models, became deep learning models, which means in what I was talking about, you have the inputs, outputs, and you have units in the middle, which are called hidden units, used to have one layer. And that's where I was saying there was a theorem that said you could learn anything, but nobody really knew how to do it. You put in more layers, so you call it deep, like 2, 3, 4, up to people have done 152 and more, I'm sure. But then you can recognize things really well, and like the chess board or the Go board. I know chess better than Go, so stick to chess.
Sure, sure.
And you can recognize and decide what are the likely set of moves, and then you can explore those moves for see how well they should pan out as you go into the future. You have to do some search still.
How much of this is clever programming and how much of this is raw computational horsepower?
That's a good question. I would say that the learning part is computational horsepower. But, you know, somebody did come up with clever programming for some of that.
Of course.
The clever programming – so the first great chess program, Deep Blue, was more about clever programming. Wasn't much learned. They had really a lot of information from chess experts. They had a lot of search. They used all the time that they had for search. I think Alpha Zero doesn't have to use that much. I think it was doing really well with like 3 minutes of computation time.
Mm-hmm.
So most of it is learned, most of it. That might be too strong, but a large portion of it is learned now.
So basically, just to boil it down, so what's happening is you set up a computer, you teach it the rules, and then you have it play itself because of the computational horsepower that's available millions of times, and it can look way off into the future of every move, and then eventually it can take all that data, and it becomes a really great chess player.
Yeah, I would
say fairly.
I
mean, it's simplified.
It's close. I don't think it has to look way off into the future. That's the interesting part. But it does, there has to be some looking into the future. Yes, and then it's able to do really well. And part of the reason that we have this explosion in performance is because there are graphical processing units, GPUs.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. We will get to that in just a second. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking to Dr. Larry Hall. He's distinguished university professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Florida. We're sitting down with him while he's in town for a lecture. If you would like to join our conversation, you can engage with us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We're at WGCU. You can use the hashtag GCL. So GPUs are graphical processing units, which would be like what's in a video card.
Right.
They're like chips, the processors that run computers. But what's different? Because they have much more powerful properties for doing this kind of math, basically?
They're really good, at matrix multiplication, matrix operations. And you can think of a deep neural network as being a set of matrix operations. I think a company calls it tensors, which is true. And they have a deep learning system called TensorFlow. I choose not to advertise the company, but you probably have used it.
And so at what point did researchers realize that these GPUs were going to be applicable like this? Were they invented for computer science and then they became useful for graphics, or was it the other way around?
They were invented for graphics and gamers used them, and then people said, wow, I can do all these computations to render these pictures for these games. Well, can I use it to do computations for things that are more scientifically interesting perhaps?
Right, right. And then the other side of that, and we'll get back to AI here in a second though, is that this is what Bitcoin miners or crypto miners are using. And it's driven up the cost of graphics cards because people are mining cryptocurrencies, right?
That's correct. So we have a GPU supercomputer and we were trying to buy more cards for it. And we had a very hard time doing it. We went to a vendor and they promised us cards and they couldn't get them themselves for a while. So yes, it's because of the Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is not the only one. There's Ethereum and Moreno and lots of cryptocurrencies. Hmm.
So what is driving the current buzz around AI in the world today? What are the main things where we're seeing it become a part of our lives, and where are the big hopes right at this time?
I think deep learning is driving the buzz. And cars that are autonomous, right? They use some learned models because you cannot teach it every sign. I mean, right, the stop sign, the 45-mile-an-hour sign, but then you have to teach the 55-mile-an-hour sign and the 70-mile-an-hour sign. And I can tell you the drivers on 75 do not understand the 70-mile-an-hour sign. But you want your deep neural network to do that. So you want it – you want your car to do that. So you want it to be learned. So I think that's something that people see. But AI has been used in applications for a while. It's just that when it's used, people don't call it AI anymore.
Right.
So if you've ever seen dynamic pricing, since I do a bunch of flying, I'll see this when I'm trying to buy airplane tickets. If I hit too many times searching on the same flight, I can have it go up because it says, there's demand.
Gotcha.
Right? And that's an AI algorithm.
And that's some sort of some place where we would cross paths with what we think of as artificial intelligence.
Yes. There's an AI algorithm that did that.
So big data, we know this term now, big data, there's all this data being collected. And so then these neural networks are being merged or being – the big data is feeding into them.
Yep.
And that's where a lot of this is happening, right,
these days? Right. So I think the first really big wake up for everybody was and this competition to recognize objects in camera scenes. So I think the top five error, meaning that you got the object right in the top five predictions that you have, was something like 25% error in 2011 or 10. It's now 3.5%, I think.
And you're talking about feeding a picture into a computer and it knowing what it is, or being able to identify it.
By able to identify the objects in it. So this is a huge differential, right? And it came up – and the thing about the particular implementation of deep neural networks, you don't have to pick out the features. So before you had to say, well, if it's basketballs, I should look for round stuff. Now I just give it pictures of things and let it pick out the features in a convolutional neural network. So pretty much anybody can build them because you don't have to understand them as long as you get lucky with your architecture. It helps if you understand them, but anybody can build because you don't need any features. You don't need to know what they are.
Is there a connection here between when you are asked if you're a robot and it asks you to look at the pictures, which ones have signs in them? Is somebody using those choices to help inform some sort of neural network that's trying to solve this problem?
So that's
I've always wondered that.
Right. So that's supposed to defeat the algorithms, right?
Right, right.
But you can, of course, as you just said, so if these learning algorithms are good, they should be able to learn to beat the CAPTCHAs. And in fact, people regularly do this kind of thing. They build a model that beats the CAPTCHAs. And the problem is if that model gets into the wild, then everybody can use it and then you have no more be a bot.
Yeah, you need a new way.
Right.
So the idea of doing this with pictures is that, obviously, you could see it being useful with a self-driving car so it can identify what else is around it.
Right.
You can see it being useful on social media because it says, hey, that's a picture of Larry Hall and
right.
It knows it's you. Where else? Where are the other places that this is becoming applicable or will hopefully be applicable in this realm?
Well, if you want to identify people, as you said, but the people are – I think in London, they have cameras all over the place and
mm-hmm.
you could – to potentially identify who did something on a street, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's along the lines of what you were saying. If you want to know, for example, how the growth of plants is or your crops are and you have a drone flying over, you can identify anywhere that there's spots that may be indicating disease.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you want to see if there's weeds, you should be able to identify those from, again, and it doesn't have to be a drone, but it could be because it's hard to walk acres and acres of fields.
Right, right. It's being able to identify what a camera is seeing without a human being involved,
right.
Basically, is what it boils down to.
That's right. That's right.
So when it comes to self-driving cars, what are the ways that AI is being used beyond this image identification?
So self-driving cars are not my specialty, so I don't want to – anything I say can and will be questionable.
We can stay right up on the surface, don't worry.
It's definitely doing that kind of thing. I think that there's some in actually making smooth – some AI built involved in making smooth turns and smooth stops. There's some in reasoning about what to do with it. So I've recognized a bicycle and it's in front of me and do I need to stop or has it got enough speed to get out of my way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, or a car, right? When we come up to a stop, intersection of a car is going through and we have right away, but there, we don't have to stop. But if we're going to hit them, we do stop.
Yeah. I was surprised when I was looking through your presentation that you're going to be giving tonight that at the end you go into GitHub, which is a place where computer programmers interact from afar and they have all the different thing. Look it up, people. It's very confusing but also very helpful if you're a computer programmer. How does that connect to AI?
Well, so GitHub is something that we've been looking at as a social media platform. And if you think about – it turns out that commercial software – 80% of commercial software has free software in it. And GitHub is a place where there are lots of open public repositories of software, and that may well be in the software that you're using. Some of it may be in there. So one of the things that is interesting is looking at how it's used as a social platform, how people interact. But we're also looking at that with Twitter and Reddit, so I think everybody knows what Twitter is. Reddit is a place where people comment on different kinds of things, but in particular software would be the issue here. And seeing how the cross-platform interactions happen with the look at how information flows in social networks because that has some greater ramifications. And we're not looking at social networks like tweets per se.
Right.
But overall trying to understand how it flows.
And you said in GitHub that you could see a correlation between movement in the realm of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency based on the amount of interactions that were happening within GitHub in that regard. Is that accurate?
Yes. So, because we have funding, we can't exploit this, but we do see some clear correlations, at least in the past, GitHub has certainly been manipulated. I mean, as you may remember, it went up to $20,000.
Oh, Bitcoin?
Bitcoin has been manipulated.
There should be a BitHub.
There should be. But you can see that there's a lot of action going on in GitHub about the same time that this thing is going up, and probably people are trying to build faster Bitcoin miners. When that's going on.
I didn't even put this in my script, but I'm going to think about it right now. Are there presumably people who are trying to use big data and machine learning and neural networks to figure out stocks and investments?
Yeah, I'm sure there are. I think that you probably can do – so backing up, I had a friend who had a company, and they used machine learning, mostly evolutionary computation algorithms. And through the 90s, they outpaced the market all the time. They always tell me, we are 3% better, 2% better, whatever, than the Dow. But when the dot-com bust happened, they busted too because it was no longer kind of like what happened before, and it just couldn't do things. And I think that would be the same problem today. You have to learn from something. You don't learn from the unexpected kinds of things that have been going on in the market right now. I would be willing to guess that learned models the last few months have done really bad.
Yeah. When it comes to developing this idea of an artificial general intelligence, I'm going to get a little science fiction here, but the more the decades go by, the less science fiction I think it seems. Do you think that it's even conceivable that there could be something that sort of emerges from all the data that we have in terms of, we see all throughout the natural world, we see complicated stuff emerge from big systems that don't have the parts to, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Is that still just straight up Arthur C. Clarke, or what do you think?
From my understanding, that's pretty much Arthur C. Clarke.
Okay.
I don't think emergent intelligence is very likely now, until now, because we don't allow our learned models to modify themselves. Our learning algorithm can't modify itself, and it's not usually learning all the time. There are people who are working on things that are constantly modifying. But if you have a good model and it's self-modifying, then maybe you could have something that's emergent. And maybe it will someday be conscious. I talked to a philosopher, well-known philosopher who I won't name, but I expect him to say there's no chance that a learned model will ever be conscious. He was not willing to say that.
You talked earlier about the singularity, about this idea that, eventually there could be something that can do everything we can do. But then if it becomes self-learning, like what you were just described, it might be able to get a lot smarter,
yes,
a lot more quickly, like exponentially,
yes,
quickly. And that's what people are concerned about,
yes,
when you hear people say things like that.
Right.
How much of that is always on y'all's mind in this world of research into artificial intelligence?
That's a good question. I think it is on people's mind, but it's, in their little silos, not necessarily uppermost in the mind. The IEEE has started a ethics in AI standards kind of approach, which I think is good. If you've read Asimov's The Three Laws of Robotics, you're shaking your head, yes, so you have. So we probably actually need something like that we build into our program so that they are ethical. There are other ethical kinds of issues with the programs. If you put in data that's biased, you're going to get biased decisions.
Last question. What, if you had to make an educated guess, what might be a next increment forward in this world of machine learning and neural networks? Is there like the next step that people are thinking might be around the corner before too long?
I'd say in a very useful intelligent assistant, there are already things like Alexa and Google Home and Siri, but those are pretty limited. You ask them many questions you can ask them, they don't know, and they don't know what to do about it. But I think maybe in some 5-10 years, they'll be pretty good at, getting you answers or saying, okay, you want to go to dinner at restaurant X? Well, good luck with that. They don't have reservations for tonight. But if you are willing to go next week, you could get them, or maybe tomorrow night, right? Which is not currently a state of the art.
Maybe kind of like a passing the Turing test, only we know that it's a computer. So it's kind of like a suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
But we still have a human type feeling interaction.
Right. Yeah. I think that's one possible way.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Larry Hall, is Distinguished Professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of South Florida. Dr. Hall, thank you for spending some time with us and, you know, geeking out with me.
Thanks. It was fun.
Thanks also to our earlier guest, J.P. Brooker from the Ocean Conservancy, during our segment about its new report on the 9 most urgent threats facing Florida's coasts and oceans. If you tuned in during our show today and would like to hear it in its entirety, tune in tonight at 9 after the TED Radio Hour to hear the re-air, or you can always hear full episodes on our website, gulfcoastlive.org. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.